Hello everyone, welcome to our new book series. In this series, we invite a variety of scholars who mainly focus on international security studies. Our aim is to introduce newly published books about international security, terrorism, and defense studies to understand the change in the nature of international and regional security. Today, we have Dr. Yannick Villeux-Lepage with us. Dr. Villeux-Lepage is currently an assistant professor of terrorism and political violence at the Institute of Security and Global Affairs at Leiden University. He was previously a senior researcher in the Transcultural Conflict and Violence Initiative at Georgia State University. His work there included analyzing media products and online discourse produced by extremist groups. Dr. Villeux-Lepage holds a doctorate in international relations from the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. And prior to his academic career, he worked as a senior intelligence analyst specializing in international terrorism and emerging threats for the government of Canada. His research interests include the creation of online narratives and propaganda which fosters or normalizes terrorism, historical antecedents to terrorism, far-right extremism and the transnational links of far-right groups, ideological and technical diffusion, and the application of evolutionary approaches to social sciences. His new book, How Terror Evolves, The Emergence and Spread of Terrorist Techniques, builds on his doctoral research, which draws on evolutionary theory to explain how new techniques of political violence appear, transform, spread, and disappear. So without further ado, let's start with the first question of our interview. Welcome, Dr. Lepage. Could you explain the main argument of your book and how it will contribute to the current literature on terrorism, please?
Yeah, absolutely. So the motivation for the book really came out at observing new trends within the manifestation of political violence that was occurring in 2015, 2016. And particularly, I was looking at the phenomenon of vehicle ramming and how this phenomenon seemed to have emerged from the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and then had been adopted by jihadi Salafists. And we remember this kind of wave of vehicle ramming attacks in Europe in 2015, 2016. And then later on was starting to be legitimized or was appearing more and more within far-right discourse and was also used by far-right actors as a way of doing retributory attacks. And as I was looking at this particular technique, I started essentially asking myself three guiding questions. And these are the three guiding questions that are really at the core of the book itself. And the first question has to do with how do new terrorist techniques emerge? So the way that we commit political violence is constantly changing, but I was interested in understanding what are the various factors that might lead to the emergence of new manifestation of political violence. The second question that I sought to answer was how do these new techniques spread? So we know that a technique that emerges in one context is often seen or repeated in other contexts by other groups that might not necessarily have any kind of close linkage. It might be used by groups that are even kind of on the opposite spectrum. So how is it that new technique spread was the second question I really wanted to answer. And the last question had to do with what are the factors that might help us understand why a group might decide to use a new technique or might simply say, you know what, this particular technique is outside the realm of what we do. So that was the third question, which is what explains the adoption and rejection of new terrorist techniques. So what the book tries to contribute is a framework. It's essentially a way to look at the full life cycle of a new technique of political violence, to trace its emergence, to trace its transmission, and then to trace its adoption and rejection by various groups. And I do this specifically by looking at airplane hijacking starting in 1931 all the way to the 2001 9/11 attacks that we're all very familiar with. So, in a nutshell, the contribution here is a theoretical framework that can be applied or that is applied to airplane hijacking, but hopefully that analysts and academics and scholars of terrorism can apply to other case studies in order to explain, you know, the emergence, the spread, and the adoption of new forms of political violence.
Okay, thank you. Then we can continue with the second question. What do you think is the general trend of terrorist technique innovations? Are there any signs of uneasiness in coming up with further innovations as technology progresses? Does the gap between government action and terrorist action ever widen? Are there any government policies that are so technologically advanced that terrorist organizations cannot come up with a feasible innovative reactions?
All right, so there's a lot to this question itself, but I think a way to answer this question is start unpacking this question is to go back to the theoretical framework and start looking at some of the knowledge that's generated about the emergence of new terrorist techniques or how and why does terrorist innovation occur. And one of the arguments that I make here is that innovation doesn't come out of a vacuum. It's a problem-solving endeavor. It's directly linked to a desire for a competitive advantage by terrorist groups. And this is a competitive advantage against their adversaries, whether that's the state, the security service, or other terrorist group itself. But also that there's a myriad of different factors that come into play. There's a myriad of sources of innovation that we can see playing out. So one of them is change in security environment. So whenever there's a counterterrorism strategy or initiative that is imposed or that is brought into the field, this changes the security environment and that pushes terrorists to adapt or to change the way that they're operating. And we have many examples of this, but I think probably the example I like using the most has to do with in the aftermath of the LL-426 hijacking by the PFLP in 1968, we start seeing the emergence of sky marshals on airplanes. We also see the introduction of profiling at various security check by LL staff. And we see that the PFLP responded to that very quickly with the PFLP general command, you know, changing its strategy to go more towards targeting LL flights with bombs. We also know that the PFLP EO changed its strategy and started recruiting foreign operatives in order to counteract or to defeat these profiling attempts. So that's one of the trends that we see. We also know that changes in new technology, so the emergence of new technology is very important in fueling terrorist innovation. New technologies allow things that were impossible before to become possible. And it's not only the emergence of new technology, but Audrey Cronin does a great argument in her new book, also on terrorist innovation, called Power to the People, where she talks about the role of the democratization of new technologies. So it's not only about a new technology being invented, it's about a new technology becoming more and more accessible to non-state actors, and therefore it can become weaponized. And this is something that I think about a great deal when I'm thinking about kind of the next frontiers, and I'm thinking about the role or the future of 3D printed weapons or weaponized drones, a topic that I've written about with my colleague Emile Archambault, but also the kind of the what is the threat and the possibilities that are brought forward with synthetic biology and genetic hacking. Now, the last aspect really kind of comes back to this question of, you know, is there technologies that terrorist organization, you know, cannot dream up or cannot come up with a feasible, you know, innovation with? And really it has to come back down to this democratization. 15, 20 years ago, the technology that is linked with genetic hacking and synthetic biology was something that was only accessible to researchers and extremely, you know, with extremely expensive equipment, with massive government grants, with, you know, laboratories that would make your eyes water. And now this technology can be used or can be purchased on eBay for a couple of hundreds of dollars and has been democratized. So there is this arm race, and as technologies become more efficient, more effective, and cheaper, it becomes more accessible to terrorist actors. And history has told us that non-state actors are very, very quick to seize on new technologies. And I always like to go back to history when I make these arguments, but you know, the flintlock musket was invented in Europe in 1550. And then 20 years later, we had the first assassination of a head of state, James Stewart, with a firearm. So it only took 20 years ago for firearm technology to be used by terrorists 500 years ago. And I think we're seeing this acceleration now of that. Now, the last kind of factor that I think is quite important here has to do with this gap between government action and terrorist reaction, and is it widening? And I think one of the things that's particularly interesting to keep in mind is that I believe that terrorists have a distinct evolutionary advantage over governments. And what I mean by this is that terrorist groups are able to adapt and respond much quicker than governments are able to adapt and respond. And that simply has to do with like bureaucratic constraints of both these groups, but it also has to do with this desire for competitive advantage. Terrorist groups have to continue evolving if they want to continue operating in an environment where they are significantly weaker and have significantly less resources than their adversaries. And Dominic Johnson at Oxford has done some fantastic work looking at this notion of evolutionary advantage between terrorist groups and governments. So in many ways, if we want to make this gap shorter, if we want to become more apt at reacting to terrorist innovation, I think we need to streamline the way we think about counterterrorism. And I think there needs to be also a much more proactive approach to new technologies. So rather than waiting for new technologies to be weaponized, I think it's important that we start thinking about what is the potential threat that these emerging technologies might pose in the future.
I see. So the government should start thinking as a terrorist organization and consider what these new technologies can be weaponized in the future against the government. All right. The third question is, changes in security environment by new measures against terrorist tactics are always bypassed by countermeasures that involve innovations. This tendency seems leading to a spiral model of further armament of both sides. Starting from this point of view, how would you analyze the effectiveness of security measures directed against terrorist techniques? Do these security measures have the potential to become more than actions that merely save the day? Can these security measures be influential in ending of terrorism at all?
All right, so this is a very good question. And the short answer is no, it is not possible to end terrorism. We can mitigate terrorism, we can reduce threats, but the nature of human nature is that conflicts exist. Conflicts have always existed. We have records of organized interspecies violence dating back, you know, 400,000 years ago. And this isn't going to go away. Now, what we do see is that techniques are, techniques can be affected or are sensitive to various different pressures. And this is the last aspect of the framework that I present, is this notion that techniques are adopted if they're seen as feasible, they're adopted if they're seen as legitimate by the people who are going to use it, and they're adopted if they're believed to be effective later on by those who are going to use it, both for their outcome goal and their process goals. And this is a place where governments and counterterrorism agencies can shift the balance. This is a place where they can play with the variables. So when we're talking about feasibility, this really comes up like the nature of a lot of counterterrorism strategy is to make some techniques less feasible. And we do this by like controlling goods. We do this by seizing assets, by trying to stop terrorism financing and so on. And this is great and it's helpful, but it's not a silver bullet. because we know, thanks to the work of people like Todd Sanders, that there is something called a substitution effect that takes place, which essentially means that if you make one technique less feasible, another technique will end up being more attractive in comparison. And the a great example here is in 1973, the United States government essentially mandated that all airports in the United States have metal detectors. And this led to a massive reduction of airplane hijacking. However, at the same time, during the same period, what we saw is an increase in embassy takeover, in kidnapping, and in assassinations. So what we're doing is we're displacing one technique to another. And this is a discussion that we have after the spree of vehicle ramming attacks in Europe, was that you could put bollards from, you know, London to Aberdeen. You could spend billions of dollars protecting pedestrians from this particular type of attack, but people that are criminally that are ideologically minded to and want to use political violence to achieve these means are not just going to say, oh, I can't engage in a vehicle ramming attack, I'm going to go get a job at Walmart instead, and I'm going to do something very different. They're going to shift to another type of attack, for example, a stabbing attack that might be more feasible. So that's one way we can shift things. The next thing has to do with legitimacy. Groups, when they're using a particular technique, will justify the use of this technique to make sure that it falls within their kind of like ideological worldview, but also to make sure that it aligns with their constituency, the people that they are proclaiming to represent or to act on the behalf of. And this is one of the places where we can shift the balance, is engaging with community stakeholders in the aftermath of an attack to make sure that techniques or certain acts are decried by credible voices within these communities. And then the last question that has, or the last factor has to do with effectiveness. And this is one that's very hard to figure out. It's very hard for terrorists to figure out what technique is going to be effective and which one is not. And often it can only be kind of tested out by putting the technique in practice. But this is one of the places where our response in the aftermath of a terrorist attack can have some impact on whether or not a technique is used again.
All right, thank you very much. Our next question is, in this action-reaction framework that you meticulously observe and review, what policies can be implemented to minimize the possibility of a terrorist organization coming up with a reaction? What can be done to limit the relational and unrelational ties that spread techniques?
Yeah, so the notion of relational and unrelational ties, for those who haven't had a chance to read the book, is essentially has to do with the notion of transmission. And the argument here is that knowledge, all types of knowledge, including how to engage in a terrorist act or the kind of MO for particular terrorist techniques, can be transmitted in two ways. It can be transmitted by what we call relational ties or interpersonal channels, which is when one group has an alliance or shares information directly with another group. The second source of transmission is what we call non-relational ties. And this essentially happens when a group decides to adopt a new technique by observing it from afar, by essentially copying another group that engages in that particular technique. And non-relational ties are very important. We see those occurring a great deal, right? This is what explains, for example, why vehicle ramming migrated as a technique from the repertoire of jihadi Salafists to that of the far right. They observed accounts of how the far right observed accounts of how jihadi Salafists were using vehicle ramming and sought to copy essentially that particular technique. So here, one of the things that I think is quite important from a counterterrorism perspective is to be very careful as to what type of information is released to the public in the aftermath of a terrorist attack. And to make a con- or to consciously ask ourselves both as academics, as policymakers, but also as journalists about this balance between informing the public and providing information that can then be used by terrorist groups in order to copy a particular technique. Now, this doesn't only apply to successful attacks. It can also apply to unsuccessful attacks. And we see several examples of terrorists learning from the failures of other groups and adapting from the failures of other groups. So there's a delicate balance between censorship and journalistic ethics that I think must be kept in mind. I think censorship is something that's detrimental in most contexts, but at the same time, I do think it's very important for those who report and write about terrorism to think about the level of detail that they are providing, because we do know that the terrorists will read journalistic accounts, will read court records, publications on previous attacks, and learn from those previous attacks.
Then we can continue with our last question. Regarding the disputes on terrorism in technological era, common understanding gives us a futuristic picture of threat, weaponization of artificial intelligence, killer drones, and so forth. Do you believe that this discourse is based on actual evidence or on a mere fear that terrorists strike into our hearts?
All right, so that's a really good question. And there's two lines of the 9/11 Commission reports that I think are particularly important. And the first one has to do with the type of failures that led to the 9/11 attacks. And it essentially says that there was four types of failures. The first one is a failure of imagination, then failure of policy capability and management. But this notion of failure of imagination to me is very important. We'll get to it in a minute. The second line in the report has to do with the fact that it is crucial to find a way to routinize, even bureaucratize, the exercise of imagination. And this is what the 9/11 report tells us. And I think this lesson needs to be applied when we're looking at the next step, or when we're looking at threats that are coming in the kind of medium term. If we only based our threat assessments based on what's happening right now and what's already been attempted by various groups, we're missing out a much wider picture of what could happen. And in many ways, we saw how detrimental this was. In my book, I list out about two dozen 9/11-like attacks that occurred prior to 9/11, plots, 9/11-like plots that had been uncovered prior to 9/11. But nonetheless, that particular threat, that particular technique didn't seem to be very high on in threat assessments. So when I'm looking at futuristic techniques, what I generally like to do is that if there's no clear evidence of terrorist groups or politically minded individuals using these technologies for nefarious purposes, what I like to start looking at instead is look at how criminals and hobbyists are using these technologies. And the reason I do so is that I find that criminals are generally much better innovators than terrorists. And the reason, I think, is that money is a better motivator for innovation than ideology. So if I'm looking at something like 3D printers, synthetic biology, whatnot, I like to look at how criminals have been using this technology. And for example, we're now talking about the weaponization of drones. Many people have written about how ISIS has managed to weaponize 3D printed drones, but also a bunch of other groups, PKK, for example, and so on. But we also know that criminals have been using remote control drones for like 20 years to bring drugs and weapons and cell phones into prison. So the exercise in imagination required here to see the threat that that drones could have posed isn't that difficult if we kind of step away from the terrorism spectrum and we start looking at how criminals are using this new technology. Same thing goes with looking at hobbyists. And I really like to look at hobbyists. So these are people that don't have any kind of malevolent interests. They're not politically minded. They're just interested in these new technologies and they want to see what the full capability of these technologies are. So I'm very interested in seeing what they're doing with 3D printed technology, what they're doing with drones, what they're doing with synthetic biologies, because it then gives us a good idea of, okay, what is the realm of possibility with these existing technologies? So it doesn't take very long to go on YouTube and see what people are able to do with this technology, and then to have a bit of an imaginary exercise, say, okay, now if these people were nefarious, how would they use that technology? And you know, I'd like to remind the listeners that I'm not the only one doing this. We also know that in 2011, LET, the Pakistani terrorist group, essentially had sent operatives to the United States in order to acquire drone technologies. And one of the things that these guys did is they spent a considerable amount of time engaging in correspondence and communication with remote control hobbyists on remote control forums, because they realized that these individuals possess a great deal of technical knowledge that would be of use to them. So going back to your question, is it based on actual evidence or merely fear? Well, I think when you're trying to make a threat assessment of how new technologies are going to be, the worst thing you can say is say, terrorists are not using this technology now, so it's not important. Let's move on. Rather, if terrorists aren't using this technology now, ask yourself, how are criminals using it and how are hobbyists using it? And that might give you, if you're lucky, it might give you some insight in how this technology can be used for politically minded violent individuals.
All right, thank you. That was actually the last question that we prepared for this interview. Thank you for sharing your time with us. Congratulations on your new book about how terror evolves. This was a great, entertaining and informative interview.
Wonderful. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
Sounds good.
All right. Thank you.